Kwantu on 702.
13 minutes after 10 o'clock, the Kwantu feature starts now. My guest is Gogo Tungezweni or Prima Chitwe. He's here with me in studio, and we're going to be having a wide-ranging conversation about current affairs, not only here in South Africa, but perhaps, if possible, touch on some of the things that are happening internationally. We know that we're still waiting for a decision out of Kenya in the presidential election there. And hopefully, whatever is decided, the people of Kenya will choose the path of peace in this moment. But Gogo Tungezweni or Prima Chitwe is here, and good evening to you. Thokoza Gogo, are you well?
Thokoza Kesh, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, I'm very, very well, Gogo. And I'm well, but I'm concerned.
You should be.
I'm deeply concerned about ourselves as a country, the Republic of South Africa. I'm deeply concerned about the African continent. I'm deeply concerned about the globe. I'm deeply concerned about humanity. I keep feeling that we are going the wrong way. With all of our advancements in science, in technology, in our understanding of natural phenomena and perhaps non-natural phenomena, there's a sense in me, a foreboding feeling in me, that we are going wrong as humanity, more so here in South Africa. I want to have a conversation with you that is going to not only draw from your understanding of current affairs as a political and economical analyst, but also as a man of the cloth, as it were, but also as a man, as a South African, as somebody who loves this country. I know that you do. I want to understand, are we, with all of the violence that we've been seeing, the shootings in the various taverns, most recently the rape of the 8 young women in the East Rand, in the West Rand, is there something going on here that we are not perhaps aware of?
Well, let me start by saying that we are not going to finish this conversation today.
Yeah.
And then say that if you are not concerned, you are dead and your spirit has not transcended yet. If you are concerned, that constitutes evidence that you are still alive.
Mm.
Because there is a lot to be concerned about in our country, on our continent, and in the world. I come at this from different angles. So the first thing which concerns me is the globalization of misery.
Yeah.
And my fear is that as long as this globalization of misery persists, the world will not know peace. As long as individuals and groups of individuals in the world do not have inner peace, the world will not know outward peace. So that's my first concern. The second concern is that for those of us, as you said, who are spiritual, it is very clear that the forces of darkness are on the rise. There is plenty of evidence. You have quoted gender-based violence, for instance, things that are happening in our political space, what you see in the Ukraine, what you see developing between China and Taiwan, what may be developing actually around Donald Trump in the United States, what you see in both the South and East China Sea, and other possible flashpoints in the world, suggest that the forces of darkness are on the rise. But what we tend to do is to be obsessive and overly pessimistic when we experience the darkness. We forget that the darkness is rising because the light is on the rise.
Mm.
So the darkness is rising to meet the light in order to cancel it out. So paradoxically, the darkness is evidence of light.
Mm.
And therefore, yes, the darkness should concern us, but we should look to the light.
I want to ask, perhaps while we are still in this philosophical mood, right? What is the light and what is the darkness? Because I get concerned, amongst my many concerns, is that we tend to be a little too simplistic about what is good and what is bad. And we tend to be very simplistic about what we understand to be darkness and light. And I've come to understand, Gogo, that in darkness there is sometimes light, and in dark and in light there is sometimes dark. What are you referring to when you say there is darkness, a rise of darkness? What are you referring to specifically?
Well, indigenous knowledge teaches us, and I'll say this in passing, that there is chaos in order, and there is order in chaos. And therefore, your argument that there is light in darkness, and I think by extension you're suggesting there is darkness in light,
yes,
is an idea that resonates me. I mean, that resonates with me. Because, as I say, indigenous knowledge teaches us that there is order in chaos, and there is chaos in order. In other words, things in the universe, amongst other things, are always in a state of flux. So when I greet you, I say Thokoza, or I say Thokozani. What am I saying? When I say Thokoza, when I say Thokozani, I am wishing you harmony in your relationship with God or the source of the universe, whatever it is that you believe. I am wishing you harmony in your relationship with the universe and what lies beyond it. In other words, I'm wishing you harmony in your relationship with the multiverse. I am wishing you harmony in your relationship with your ancestors. It does not matter whether you believe in them or not, but I still wish you harmony in your relationship with them. I wish you harmony in your relationship with nature. I am wishing you harmony in your relationship with others. I am wishing you harmony in your relationship with self. Anything that disturbs this harmony is a force of darkness. Anything that promotes this harmony is a force of light. We can quibble about how light or dark our experience is, but that is what I am talking about when I talk about the light, when I talk about the darkness, that which disturbs harmony at all these and other levels. Others will talk about not light and darkness, but will talk about good and evil. If that which disturbs this harmony is evil, then I agree with you. I will term it evil. If that which promotes harmony at all these levels is good, then I will agree with you that we're talking about good.
And so it brings me to the issue of relative experience. that what we experience can be something that is bad in terms of our experience of that particular phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I'll make you an example.
Mm-hmm.
If I live in Kagiso, for example, and I am exposed to the tyranny, for example, of the Zamazamas, to use the conversation of the moment, and I am of a certain level of exposure and education, I would speak in these terms. Basotho are very bad people. Ne?
Mm-hmm.
My relative experience, my experience with that situation would translate to Basotho people are very bad people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I take a more panoramic view of that same experience, I could then further argue and say, no, it's not Basotho people that are bad.
Mm.
It is a particular criminal who happens to be a Mosotho,
mm-hmm,
that is bad to you.
Mm-hmm.
And if I move even further panoramically on this particular phenomenon, I'm just choosing one, and we could choose many in South Africa and things, mm, that are taking place.
Mm.
I could argue that this is nothing more than a process of the reclamation of a people who were dispossessed of their land,
mm-hmm,
at a certain point in time by a particular political development in South Africa at a particular moment in time that we are actually witnessing here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could keep going as I rise in my panoramic view of a particular issue. And the same is true for the conversation around the tensions that exist between South Africans at a particular level with Zimbabweans at a particular level. The same could be true with South Africans and Chinese, Pakistanis, and so forth. And again, I'm talking here because my mind is refreshed. I've just had a conversation with Aaron Motsoaledi of Home Affairs. But the whole thing could be true for business, for any situation.
Mm.
Now, talk to me about how do we, in those scenarios, begin to curate, decide as to what is good and what is bad.
Well, what must kick in is compassion. Had I known you would fly so high, I would have brought one of my favorite quotations from Albert Einstein. And what is not appreciated about Albert Einstein is the fact that he had a beautiful philosophical mind.
Mm.
And a lot of what he had to say philosophically makes sense to me. One of the things he talks about is compassion. And how we reserve compassion only for those who are like us.
Mm.
And in doing so, we move in the opposite direction of what compassion demands and dictates. It dictates that we widen the circle of compassion to include even those who are not like us. So in this space where compassion exists, must reside those who are like us and those who are not like us. In my own view, a special place must be reserved for those who are not like us. And that is why when I read in the Bible the injunction that you should love your neighbor as you love yourself, I say the injunction is incomplete. The goal must be to love your neighbor more than you love yourself. That's what we should strive for. But let's take a Buddhist angle. I'm not Buddhist, but a lot of what you find in Buddhism resonates with me. So the problem we have is attachment. Attachment to people, attachment to ideas, our opinions, our worldview, organizations, political parties, religion, and so on, identity, and so on.
Yeah.
Now, what Buddhism teaches us is that life is suffering. What is the source? What is the source of that suffering?
Yeah.
The source of that suffering is attachment. And how do we free ourselves from the suffering? They say we must detach. I don't like the word detach. For me, the opposite of attachment is not detachment. The opposite of attachment is freedom. Beyond attachment lies freedom. So there may be plenty of evidence that the view that Basutu are evil killers is unsustainable. But because you are attached to the view, because you either refuse or lack the ability to free yourself from the known, that attachment will cause you suffering, and as a result, you will cause suffering to others. And the challenge, therefore, for people like me is to talk more and more about the need to free ourselves from the known. Of course, you can't free yourself from that which you do not know. So you start with the known. Now, that person whose experience of Basutu or Zamazamas or whatever is a bad experience. First of all, we can't deny that that is his or her experience. Mm. What we can help that person do is to undergo a process of freeing herself or himself from this known. Because once that happens, there is room then for widening the circle of compassion. We can also take the root of trauma.
Yeah. Does that process of helping that person with that experience, and I see that you're saying that there needs to be an acknowledgement of that experience.
Hmm.
How do we acknowledge that experience?
Well, not to acknowledge the experience is to lack compassion. So what we tend to do is to rush towards condemnation.
Mm.
Instead of rushing towards understanding. To seek to understand is not to condone that which should be condemned. So we can seek to understand two things in this specific example we are giving. The behavior of this Zamazama Musutu guy who goes on a killing and raping spree. What causes? Not a Musutu. Because you can go to many parts of the world, you will find human beings are doing the same thing.
Yes.
So what causes a human being to do this to other human beings? We must seek to understand that. And to seek to understand that does not mean you condone the action. Now, that man or woman who is angry, who says a shaft must be shut down and closed, and some say violently so, they too, you must seek to understand what it is that drives them to respond to this in this manner.
And that seeking to understand is not a condoning of that.
No, not at all. It's not to condone.
Or justification.
Nor is it a justification. You are right. Because as I say, if you do not want to understand what is behind the evil acts of one and the sometimes people say irrational or unreasonable response of the victim of these evil acts towards the doer, in both cases they are lacking compassion. We are called upon to show compassion to both the doer and the victim of the doing. Now, of course, some will then say, but they too can be treated as equal. Now, for me, that does not even arise, because that would imply that I'm being mechanical in how I engage with this. But to stop there is to engage in an esoteric philosophical discussion.
Yes, yes. And we are dealing with very practical matters here. And the reason why I start philosophically and esoterically is because I'm looking for a foundation upon which we can move, from which we can move in our discussion about world events. One of the questions I'm going to ask you about that is the fact that we have laws, regulations, protocols, mores, customs, ways by which societies, communities manage themselves in an effort to not have chaos that comes about as a result of people wanting perhaps their own issues to be prioritized for whatever reason. We have those kinds of things in society. I want you to talk to me about what you think the status of that regulatory framework, formal or informal, what that status is within the framework of the compassion that you're talking about. And let me throw in a bit of a spanner in the works. South Africa, Africa has been a victim of the scourge of imperialism, colonialism, from the global north, on both sides of the global north, the east and the west, in many cases. What of the evils that have been visited on this continent and the issue of compassion to those that have visited the evil whose legacy continues?
Well, I'm happy you are going there. I can see you are in full flight today. I'm glad you are going there.
Thank you, sir.
Because you then have to talk about what I almost always talk about when these conversations come up. We must talk about Western modernity. In particular, the darker side of Western modernity, which is coloniality. A logic which says that those who are not European and white are ontologically inferior. In other words, they are not human. And then it says those who are not European and white are epistemologically inferior. You can visit upon them as a colonizer, in the process of colonizing them, all forms of cruelty, impose forms of knowledge and systems that are pernicious to their existence, impose epistemicide on them. In other words, what they know to be true is false, and what they know to be false is true.
Yeah.
And here we are now. We link this to the problem of attachment. One of the reasons why coloniality arises, it arises as a justification for attachment to money. An attachment to money, which means you must take from another resources by whatever means, because you have another justification. The logic of coloniality has declared them non-human, not human. And therefore, you understand why F.W. de Klerk struggled with the idea that apartheid was a crime against humanity, because he is informed by the logic of coloniality, according to which we are not human. And therefore, what they do during colonialism and apartheid cannot be wrong, because it is done to those who are not human. But look at the extent of the dehumanization. Because of this attachment to money, you create systems. And one of the most evil systems that the human mind has devised is capitalism. And when you look at what is happening in those communities where fights are developing with Zamazamas, and the reality of Zamazamas themselves, one way of looking at that is with regard to the fact that capitalism is one of the most evil things the human mind has devised, and disturbs harmony, disrupts harmony, destroys harmony at so many levels. We are here now. There can be no peace without justice. So I can preach compassion all I like. In the absence of justice, there can be no peace. In the South African context, we know what justice should look like. It should be the antithesis of what obtained as a social, political, and economic order during colonialism and apartheid.
Do we then apply justice first or compassion first? I ask this question because the family of a young girl who was raped will probably agree with you that in order for a man to rape a woman brutally in that fashion, there must be there must be a dehumanization of that person. Along the same lines that colonialism dehumanized those that were colonized. And visited upon that young girl a similar cruelty. When we started to have this conversation, you spoke of the need for us to look through the lens of compassion. Would you look through the same lens of compassion at the colonizer that you would look through the lens of compassion at the rapist?
Well, let me start here. I want to talk about the womb. If we agree that the womb is a sacred space, we must agree also that she in whom the womb resides is a sacred being. And therefore, to visit upon that being rape and other forms of violence is to violate a sacred being. And so, what it means is that in the process of change, we men, first of all must take collective responsibility for this. Because remember, patriarchy is a system. It's a system of oppression. And it is one of the reasons this violation of this sacred being occurs. Of course, yes, it starts with coloniality, which says the white man is God's representative on earth. The white man is God to the black man. And the black man is God to the black woman. And so we as men should kneel at the feet of this sacred being we call woman and ask for forgiveness and commit ourselves to changing who and what we are. And one of the ways in which this must happen, and this may sound abstract, you know, Ubaba Vusa Mazulu, Credo Mutu, spoke about the warrior mind and the mother mind.
Yes.
But remember that the warrior mind and the mother mind are in the same being. You, in you, have the warrior mind and the mother mind.
Mm-hmm.
A man has a warrior mind and a mother mind. A woman has a warrior mind and a mother mind. The question is, which one is pronounced? And if you look at the 20th century, the warrior mind was more pronounced. Now, if you use numerology, for instance, everyone born in the 20th century has a number 9 in their birth date.
Yes.
What does that number represent? Amongst other things, it represents idealism. There was very little of that during the 20th century.
Mm.
Responsibility. There was very little of that during the 20th century. And ambition. There was a lot of that during the 20th century. Ambition for power, political and economic. And that is why the 20th century was so unstable. Now, I am optimistic, and the reason I'm optimistic is that with the coming of the 21st century, every person born during the 21st century will have a number 2 in their birth date, a number that represents compassion, that represents the ethical dimension, prophetic wisdom, spiritual wisdom, and so on. Which means that over the next 2 to 3 decades, what begins to emerge in the world is a more ethical or a less unethical order. But it's going to emerge painfully. Its birth is going to be painful because the hangover of what was during the 20th century will be with us. For some time. Now, of course, we cannot sit back and just say, well, you know, in the year 2150, the world will be more ethical or whatever. We don't have to do anything. No. There can be no justice without action either. So it is not enough to pray, for instance. If we must pray, we must pray that we are guided to act towards making sure that a more ethical or less unethical order, a more just order, or a less unjust order emerges. We must be guided to act. So we can meditate, we can pray, we can do all of that. If we do not pray that we are guided to act, the kind of better world we wish for is not going to materialize. Now, if you come back to where we are here in South Africa, to act means to recognize that South Africa, as I keep on saying, does not belong to all who live in it. South Africa belongs to those who conquered it. And because that is the case, there are three things about South Africa which must change. The fact that the economy is in white hands, the fact that the land is in white hands, the fact that the rule of law is in white hands. Those things must change because they are the main indicators of what I'm talking about. The fact that South Africa still belongs to those who conquered it.
Do we have the tactical, the strategic, the educational understanding of what that project means?
Well, let me talk about education in the narrowest sense. Remember that when certain interests, particularly economic, become dominant, those interests must be reproduced, reinforced, and imposed so that they remain intact. And one of the ways in which you do that is through the education system. Most of the world is exposed to an education system whose institutions are dead zones of disimagination.
Mm-hmm.
And because these institutions, our education institutions, our universities, our schools, are dead zones of disimagination, to borrow from Henri Giraud, all they do is to assist the system to reproduce itself.
Sure. Which is probably why the governing party, the ANC, has not been very imaginative in the transformation of society, such that society continues to perpetuate the seeds of what was planted by the Nats.
Well, we've been hyperventilating about state capture over the past 5 years or so. And I'm not going to say state capture has not happened, but I still argue that we take a very narrow view of what constitutes state capture. But I'm not here to discuss state capture today. What I will say is that we must remember that one of the ways you reproduce dominant social, political, and economic reality is by capturing the mind, amongst other things, by capturing institutions, organizations, powerful individuals, by creating out of those who were victims of coloniality and colonialism allies. And so on the continent, you have African leaders who are allies of coloniality. The African Union is the main ally of coloniality on the continent.
Mm.
You can say the same thing about what the ANC has become. The ANC in its current incarnation is an ally of coloniality. And this is why, for instance, Makashule Ghana, for instance, when he talks about the fact that one of the reasons he leaves the DA is because the DA seems to have lost interest in becoming the ruling party. Now, I understand why the DA has lost interest. Because it has a party that will act in the interest of his constituencies. And because of that, it does not have to be a ruling party. It does not have to win a majority in an election, because in the ANC, in its current incarnation, what the DA has is an ally of coloniality. Which means that if fundamental change must occur, we must confront this reality head on.
I'm going to take a quick break, but I do want to, as we go to a close, And I love the fact that you said that this conversation can't be ended today. I want to find out what the priority becomes. Justice or compassion?
For me, the priority is spiritual awakening. Remember that in indigenous knowledge teaches us that everything is connected. And what I have learned is that political problems are but a symptom. Economic problems are but a symptom. Social problems are but a symptom. Symptoms of a deeper malaise at a spiritual level. And that is why one of the things I want to talk about over the next few weeks and months,
sure,
is the question of the spiritual state of the nation. Because the spirit of the nation and the spirit of individuals.
You're not talking about the singing of the anthem at the Mbombela Stadium, the Springbok game, are you?
Well,
let me take a quick break. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I continue my conversation with Gogo Tungezweni or Brima Chitli. It is a marathon conversation, folks. You know that. Let's take a quick break.
Kwandu on 702.
Gogo Tungezweni or Brima Chitli is in the studio. We are having a conversation. And we understand that it is a long conversation, and that's why I'm hoping that Gogo will choose this platform for us to continue this conversation. I know that many people will want to talk to you, but I don't think that many people will understand the value of the issues that you're raising in the way that you're raising them at this moment. I want to close. We've run out of time, but you said to me that the big priority at the moment is spiritual awakening. Should we all be going to church? Should we all be, twasaying? What does that mean?
Well, remember, one of the things I have spoken about is the need to free ourselves from the no. To be spiritual to me does not mean to attach myself to any religion. To me, it means to be true to my sister. I will not tell the whole story, but the story is told of Mushasha's training.
Mm.
At the end of which, he is reminded that he can forget everything about his training, but he must listen to his sister. And his sister is that voice that never lies, that tells him truth that no one will ever tell him.
Rakhadi.
And for me, to be spiritual, amongst other things, means that we must be true to that sister and we must listen to that sister, because the sister never lies. But wherever you are in the world, if you are a Buddhist, pray for the Hindu. If you are a Hindu, pray for the Muslim. If you are a Muslim, pray for the Christian. If you are Sangoma, pray for the Christian. If you are a Christian, pray for the Jew. Pray for the atheist. We must all pray for one another. And ask the source, the universe, God, whatever you believe in, to guide us in action, to guide our actions. Because in the end, we must have these conversations. Those of us who were taught Marxism long ago were taught that ideas are not there as an end in themselves. Ideas are there so that we use them to change the world.
Faith without action is dead. Gogo Obrimajikli, it's always great talking to you. It's always entrancing to talk to you. I hope that we can continue these conversations more formally, because I think they are direly needed in this country at the moment. And I'm hoping that you'll be back again soon in the studio, so that we can continue these conversations as we go into some of the practical issues, yeah?
As the Terminator said, I'll be back.
Go good to guess when you open my chitri.